All right, the kids can be dismissed to Kingdom Kids. The rest of you, if you'd like to turn and follow along in your Bibles today, where we're going to be primarily, you will find that in Matthew chapter 16. The downside of putting the scriptures up on the TVs every message is that it's easy to come to church without your Bibles. And we'd sure love to get you back in the habit of bringing those and following them along and marking scriptures and highlighting and things like that. But we do know that there's always going to be folks that don't have them with them, so we'll keep putting the words up there, but we really want to encourage you to bring your Bibles with you. Have you ever heard it said, it's in the fine print? It's actually, if you think about it, a bit of a scary statement. If you want to go down this rabbit hole, all you have to do is go to Google and type in fine print, and you can find some of the scariest or craziest fine print that's on certain products that we enjoy. I'll give you just a couple. Amazon has one, for example. They've actually got an allowance in their fine print for a zombie apocalypse. You think I'm crazy, but here's what it says. You have to listen. I deliberately put it fine up there. They say, however, this restriction will not apply in the event of the occurrence certified by the United States Centers for Disease Control or successor body of a widespread viral infection transmitted via bites or contact with bodily fluids that causes human corpses to reanimate and seek to consume living human flesh, blood, brain, or nerve tissue, and is likely to result in the fall of organized civilization. So we thank Amazon for that. And if you think I didn't know that, I'm thinking most of you probably have used Amazon and probably never read the fine print, right? If you use iTunes, you know that iTunes is infamous for updating their terms and conditions, sometimes on a daily basis. They change them all the time. So we come very accustomed to just agreeing to whatever they tell us we have to agree to. But I bet you didn't know you agreed to this. You also agree that you will not use these products for any purposes prohibited by the United States law, including without limitation, the development, design, manufacture, or production of nuclear missiles or chemical or biological weapons. Who knew that you could use digital music for such nefarious purposes? And I'm glad they covered that in their fine print. I mean, we're used to seeing all sorts of fine print and all the various drug and prescriptions that are marketed to us on a every few second basis. And we have all these waivers we have to fill out at the events we attend or the activities we like to do. The difference with Jesus is that he never hid anything in the fine print. None of us today can claim that Jesus was unwilling to walk us through the finer points or nuances of being one of his followers. Right? I mean, we have the Bible literally at our fingertips and we can read it every single day, cover to cover if we want to. But for his first few followers, things kind of unfolded over time. He began his ministry with an invitation to a few fishermen like Peter, James, and John to simply follow him. And then he added later, I'll give you this promise, I'll make you fishers of men. And then over the days and weeks and months to come, eventually, the years that rolled by, Jesus began to refine exactly what that entailed and would be required from them until one day it became just really clear. He kind of hit it head on when he says this in Matthew 16, verse 21. From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, and that he would suffer many terrible things at the hands of the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of the religious law. He would be killed, but on the third day he would be raised from the dead. Now, this was not the first time Jesus pointed to or alluded toward his crucifixion. It's not the first time he talked about where things were heading, but this was the most specific and precise way he's ever given to them up to this point. This created an enormous amount of confliction in the hearts and minds of his disciples. They had come to believe that Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah. Peter, if you go back just a few verses, he had just recently declared that very truth. Jesus, we know who you are. We know you're from God. We know you're the Messiah. But their reality was that there would be a Messiah that was going to be a conquering king. not a suffering servant. This is not what they had imagined. They thought they were going to go into Jerusalem on war stallions, but in reality, it wouldn't be long before Jesus would ride humbly into Jerusalem on a donkey. They thought they would go into towns and dominate their enemies. They thought Jesus would literally be on the human throne. Instead, Jesus was going to die for their enemies and would hang on a cross. To say this was disorienting to them would be an understatement. And that explains why Peter had such a dramatic reaction to what Jesus said. I want you to see how Peter replied. Peter took him aside and began to reprimand him for saying such things. "Heaven forbid, Lord," he said, "this will never happen to you." Now, generally speaking, I would say that reprimanding Jesus is a bad idea. Grabbing the creator of the universe by the collars and putting his finger in your chest and telling him what he's doing wrong isn't probably the wisest decision. And it's clear at this point that Peter is full of this deadly sin called pride. In his mind, Peter has things worked out the way he wants them to be worked out, and Jesus needs a course correction. Peter also thinks he's the man for the job. Now, in all fairness, it's easy for us years later to look back and point our fingers at Peter. But we probably should be honest and realize that you and I have both done the same things. I mean, I know I have. I can honestly tell you there have been times when I wasn't all too interested in getting on Jesus' page or following along with his plan. There have been times when I was more interested in Jesus getting his mind and will with my in accordance with my plan and him getting on my page. Right? There's been times I've told him so. Think about the way we pray sometimes. Now, in one sense, I love this relational equality that Peter had with Jesus. He had built up this relationship for him where he could just be real and raw and authentic in his conversations with him. But on the other hand, if you're going to play stupid games, you have to be ready for stupid prizes, because that's kind of what Peter received. I want you to see how Peter was responded to by Jesus. Verse 23. Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Get away from me, Satan. You are a dangerous trap to me. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's." That's the verbal equivalent of a devastating left hook, right? I mean, Peter thought he was putting Jesus in his place, and the script very quickly turned over and changed very quickly. And again, it's awesome that he had this relational equity that allowed him to say anything and everything to Jesus, but that relational dynamic worked both ways, and Jesus could reply in kind. It's something you and I should probably pay attention to. When you sign up to follow Jesus, don't expect him to pull any punches. We shouldn't want him to, because even though the truth hurts sometimes, the truth is always helpful. The truth is always healing, and it's the truth that will set you free. And Jesus makes this bold claim with a capital T that he is the truth. So while Peter is taking, you know, kind of licking his wounds here, Jesus turns his attention to the rest of the disciples, and he says this to them in verse 24. "If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross, and follow me." Now, I want you to understand something. These followers, the early Christians, the early followers of Jesus, did not have the same view of a cross as you and I do. They didn't have gold chains with crosses hanging from them. They didn't have cross earrings. They didn't have tattoo crosses on their body. It'd be kind of like the equivalent today of them doing that is if we would have electric chairs hanging from our ear lobes, right? Or gas chambers tattooed on our chest. When they heard the word cross, they very quickly identified what Jesus was talking about. A cross was a brutal instrument of torture and death. In fact, it was the most feared method of death you could imagine. It was developed. It was created to be the most painful way a person could be put to death. It was literally the most unimaginable suffering and pain that could be delivered to someone. So anyone listening to Jesus at this point in time literally would have seen someone at some point in their life crucified. They had witnessed the Roman Empire treating the Jewish people very poorly over a long period of years by now. Anyone who dared rebel against the Roman government could be crucified. Sometimes the streets were literally lined with hundreds of people, men and women both, being crucified all at once. It was a stark message to everyone, you dare go against Rome. This is what will happen to you. So to Peter and to the rest of the disciples, this analogy that Jesus was using had to be absolutely stunning. They thought they were headed for comfort when Jesus all along was calling them toward a cross. And Jesus was saying to them, I'm going to go first. Now, the truth is this. You and I wake up every day of our lives in the and we have this tension between the same two things. We get up and we have to decide if we're going to gravitate toward a couch or a cross. See, a couch represents self-preservation at all costs. It's a place of least resistance. It makes no demands of me. It accommodates me in every way. It's safe. I don't have to worry about getting hurt there. So let me ask you this. If we were to wake up every single morning and we just headed from our bed to the couch and we stayed there all day, every day, we ate there, we drank there, we just rested there, we watched TV there, we played our video games there, and we did that all day long, and then we just head back to our beds, what would the outcome of that be? Well, it would lead to very poor health, eventually physical death. But long before physical death would occur, everything else in our lives would die. Emotionally, mentally, spiritually, it would all just pass away. That's what it would lead to. On the other hand, you have the cross. The cross represents self-sacrifice above all else. It's the place of most resistance. It's the place that makes demands of us. It doesn't accommodate us in any way. It's dangerous. It's guaranteed to be a place of pain and suffering. And Jesus is telling me and you and everyone else, that cross, pick it up daily. Carry it. How can that be? Let's play out the analogy. If we woke up in the morning and we silenced that voice inside of us that screams for us to pursue comfort, and we actually chose the path that we knew would cause pain, what would that lead to? We saw what the path of comfort would lead to, and that was death. What would the path that leads us toward pain lead to? Well, we know what it would lead to in the physical world. If we avoided the couch and we kept walking, we'd go for a run, we'd exercise, we'd lift weights, we'd go for a swim. What would that lead to? Health, longer life. And what Jesus seems to be saying is this, as this analogy plays out this way, is for more than just the physical realm. It applies to all areas of our life. That's why Jesus goes on to say in verse 25, if you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. The point's this. The spatter of death, burial, and resurrection is on every single page when you sign up to follow Jesus. And there's something in us that I think that resonates with. As counterintuitive as it sounds, we know deep within that Jesus is saying something that is fundamentally true on every level. As of this moment, we don't hand out awards for self-preservation. But on the flip side, what do? We honor and esteem persons of self-sacrifice. History records and monuments are set up and remind us of those who have been willing to lay down their lives on behalf of other people. In other words, they make statues of people doing things like this. Right? We don't make statues of people sitting on sofas, surrounded by pizza boxes and beer, playing video games. At least not yet. Pulitzer Prize winner and historian Rick Atkinson wrote this about the deaths of American soldiers. He said, "The most critical lesson for every American is to understand, viscerally, that this vast host died one by one by one, to understand in your bones that they died for you." There's something about that word hero that rings true to us, even in a culture that wants to elevate the anti-hero narrative above everything else. I don't have many of them, but I consider one of my parental successes that both of my children like to watch Rocky, right? Some time ago, we did movie night at our house, and Josiah got to pick the movie a few years back, and he picked Rocky III. Now, that's not my favorite Rocky movie, but it does have Mr. T and Hulk Hogan in it. And I remember after that specific night going to bed thinking, why are these Rocky movies, after all these years, such favorites? Why are they so successful? In fact, they started a new series from that first Creed, and they're just as successful. Why? It's because they play on something deep within us that we know is true. It's not a mystery. It's not rocket science. There's a pattern that plays out, and you'll see it all across all kinds of different stories and different movies. You have a main character that starts out in a place of comfort. Everything is mundane. And what do they have to do? They have to leave the mundane behind, the comfort behind, the safe behind, and they have to go on this adventure where they have to go through pain. And they go through this pain and this agony, and then they come face to face with their own demons, and they do battle with dragons and enemies and things like that. And after they battle and they gain victory, they emerge as this brand new, stronger, more powerful, more liked and esteemed person. Historically, this has been referred to as the hero's journey. You see it in classic literatures like the Iliad and Odyssey. You see it in more modern movies like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. And once you know what it is, you will see it everywhere. There's something that's in us that we just know that a hero is a person who abandons a place of comfort and walks down a path that's filled with pain. And then we figure out that the best kind of life is marked by self-sacrifice, not self-preservation. When we're able to break free from that gravitational pull of the couch and we decide to pick up a cross, it will make a difference in your home and in your life and in your neighborhood and in our church. You see, the decision to die daily to our own comforts, our own wants, our own desires is one that requires discipline. Not only because the gravitational pull of the couch is so strong, but our cultural pressure to do the same is there too. You've heard me talk a lot about this over the years, and that's deliberate on my part, because every day you and I are being bombarded by the same message from our world. You should live your best life now, get all of your wants, all of your needs, all of your comforts, because that's what's most important. Which means, Christian, we have to choose disciplines in our life that will actively fight against our own self-centeredness and the cultural pressure to pursue our own wants and desires all the time. Let me tell you a great way to fight back. Have kids. Get married, create a family, adopt children, build a home, serve them every single day. My daughter was born when I was 47 years old, and one of the first confrontations I had in that experience was my own. It was to come face to face with my own selfishness. There's nothing like having a child to reveal how devoted you are to yourself. The late night feedings, the lack of sleep, the constant attention they demand, combined with the interruption to your routine, is a serious confrontation with your own desires. It's exhausting, to say the least. But that doesn't tell the whole story of what it means to be a parent, right? Not even close, because something else happens too. Something so amazing that you could call it life-changing. So at 3 a.m., when you haven't slept for what feels like days, and you're willing to trade anything for just 2 hours of uninterrupted sleep, you also receive something you wouldn't trade for anything, and that's the deep sense of joy that comes from pouring out your life for another. Parents know what I'm talking about. The truth is there. There's more joy found in laying down your life for someone than there is in living your life for yourself. Yes, You can find short-term happiness in self-preservation, but it won't last. Kelsey Handler can write as many comedy sketches as she wants about being selfish and saying that's the good life, and she will be wrong. Andrew Tate can continue to market his counterfeit masculinity and what he calls freedom, and he'll still be a fool. Jesus was right when he said, if you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. One of Jesus' followers is a guy named Jim Elliot. He famously said this just before he was killed by the very people he was trying to share the gospel with. He said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And that's true. If Jesus is who he says he is and will do everything he has promised to do, that changes the entire dynamic of how his followers should live their lives. If we really trust and respect him, then we won't take the perspective of the ancient philosophers and modern philosophers who claim that we should get all we can when we can because life is short and then we die. If Jesus really did conquer the grave, and I believe he did, that changes everything. Here's my question. The same Jesus who said, take up your cross and follow me, also said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Question, how can both of those things be true? Take up your cross and follow me? My yoke is easy, my burden is light. Let me ask you another question. Are there different kinds of tired? Like the kind of tired you get when you sit on the couch all day doing nothing? Netflix all day? Is that the same kind of tired as the people who get tired returning from a week of hard labor? What's the difference between those two types of tired? Everything. Everything. Let me tell you the type of tired that Jesus does not want you to be. Jesus does not want you to be tired and overwhelmed by trying to earn something that he's already earned on your behalf. Jesus is not interested in accumulating more role followers who think they somehow have to gain approval by checking all of the boxes and doing a long list of things. He came to do for us what we could never do for ourselves. He lived the only perfect life that's ever been lived, so you and I don't have to spend our lives pretending to do what Jesus has already done. Jesus doesn't want you to be crushed by the weight of your own sin. He doesn't want you burdened by your shame. He doesn't want your knees buckling under your guilt that he came expressly to remove. He doesn't want you to be that kind of tired. He wants you walking freely, covered in grace, covered in mercy. He wants rest for your tired and weary soul. But that doesn't mean he wants you to be free from any kind of tired experience. The kind of tired experience when you come home from a great week of a busy vacation. That's a great tired to feel. The kind of tired you experience after working an exhausting week of vacation Bible school is the type of tired he wants you to feel. It's the type of tired that comes from spending yourself on behalf of others. And this dynamic is something that's hard to explain for someone who has never felt it. It's something you have to try. You have to get up off the couch to experience it and to understand it. That's why the Apostle Paul could write something that seems so contradictory, like this. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. persecuted but not abandoned, struck down but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. Somehow in the middle of this painful path of suffering, somehow in picking up a cross, Paul and the crew traveling with him experienced life in the very space of death. That's why he could go on to say, therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that by far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. The gravitational pull of comfort is so very strong. All of the cultural currents are pulling us that direction. But listen to me, that is not where life is found. Life is found in picking up a cross. We sing a song here sometimes called The Wonderful Cross. I love the whole song, but I really love these words. Oh, the wonderful cross, oh, the wonderful cross bids me come to die and find that I might truly live. Jesus carried a cross. It was heavy, it hurt, and it helped other people. It brought healing. And somehow this instrument of death was used to bring life. Somehow something so awful, so brutal, so terrible was used to bring forgiveness and grace and mercy. That's what Jesus did. That's what he accomplished when he went first. He established this pattern of death and burial and resurrection. And now he calls you and me to die daily and to pick up our cross and aim our lives at something that helps others heal. And he says that's where life is found. Our culture says, serve yourself, sit on the couch, follow your heart. Jesus says, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. I believe that our culture is a culture of death, this culture around us, and Jesus is the author of life. And that means every day I'm going to be confronted with this question, who am I going to follow? Who am I going to believe? Who am I going to trust? And I don't always get it right. I find myself sometimes looking out for myself and pursuing my comfort and my wants and my needs at the expense of others even. And it's in those moments that I'm so thankful for his patience with me and his grace and his mercy that's just always available to me. But what I'm trying to describe for you this morning is something that I just am telling you, you have to experience it by faith. It probably doesn't sound great in the words of a sermon. I struggle with how to put this on into words this week. But life is awesome with Jesus Christ. It's real. I'm telling you the truth, and I'm giving you some great biblical advice, but you have to experience it before you can understand it. You can come to me afterward and say, hey, Randy, what's your journey with Jesus been like for you? I try every time I preach to explain it the best I can, but I have limited tools and resources. My life has been changed since I was buried in a watery grave. But if you really, really want to know what my experience with Jesus has been, you need to jump into a relationship with him yourself. And then you'll know. Because this gift he brings and that he offers is available to every one of us, and it is something that's truly amazing. The new birth into Jesus Christ is truly a miracle. The fact that you can be born and that you can live by taking up a cross is something this world doesn't understand. It's a miracle only God can give, and for that I'm grateful.